From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. We're back from our vacation, and we begin today with an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
The main news in Venezuela, the economic measures that were introduced from July onwards by President Nicolas Maduro seem to be having some positive impact in stabilizing Venezuela's economy, especially in terms of the purchasing power of ordinary Venezuelans, which was destroyed by a whole variety of speculative attacks on Venezuela's currency, price gouging, and the whole rake of measures that are usually applied against governments targeted with economic sanctions by the United States.
Yeah, you've got economic sanctions, you've got all the games that were being played in the distribution networks where they were, you know, warehousing basic necessities and causing all kinds of distortions in the economy, blocking the country from being able to do business with half the world. All of that compounds.
Yeah, and so but that's not even people who support the Venezuelan government were very well aware that Venezuela's economy had deep structural problems that were not addressed under the administrations of President Hugo Chavez, because his priorities, and apart from the fact that he was under constant attack all the time one way or another, his priorities were to ensure that ordinary people in Venezuela benefited from the oil wealth that Venezuela had in abundance in the years of his presidency.
Right.
And so the restructuring the Venezuelan economy for at that time was a relatively low priority for the Venezuelan authorities.
Well, the kind of restructuring that Hugo Chavez did was say that there are millions of people without housing, so let's build 1 million housing units.
Yeah.
And by the way, if we can fix some of these paper problems with finance in the process, cool, but let's take care of the real economic needs first.
Yeah, exactly. So when Hugo Chavez died in 2013, that happened at the same time that the oil price was collapsing, and which obviously created very serious problems for Venezuela, because Venezuela needs the oil price to be around $60 a barrel, $60-$65 a barrel for it to be able to have a stable income from its oil production. And the price dropped well below that, and Venezuela at the same time was suffering a crisis in its ability to produce oil.
Right.
For various reasons, the whole series of reasons that I don't understand completely, but that was the situation. So restructuring the economy became a priority at exactly the same time that the political opposition were intensifying their attempts at regime change. I think that people are going to look back on the presidency of Nicolas Maduro and see it as, and judge it and evaluate it as being as important, and in some ways more important and more successful than the governments of President Hugo Chavez Frias.
Yeah.
Because what Nicolas Maduro has done is, in the first place, he's survived as a government. He's maintained the government despite the relentless assaults on via economic sanctions, diplomatic measures,
right,
the endless psychological warfare, and also the attempt at violent regime change by extremist elements in the Venezuelan opposition. He survived all that at a time when the Venezuelan economy was extremely stressed and ordinary people in Venezuela were suffering hardship, not to the extent that was portrayed in the international media, but certainly in hardship that were an extreme test of the popularity and support, the popular support for the policies of the government. And they survived all that. Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues, Diosdado Cabello and all the others, they survived all that. And not only did they survive it, but they, even through that period, they deepened the democratization of Venezuelan society via their government policies. And now, over the last few months, they've been able to introduce economic measures that address the extreme vulnerability of Venezuela's economy to exchange rate speculation, for example. And so what they've done is they've liberated the convertibility of the Venezuelan currency, which they've changed. They've changed the currency to what they call the Bolivar Soberano, essentially revaluing the currency that had become totally devalued as a result of the speculative attacks against the Venezuelan currency over the last, 4 or 5 years, something like that.
Yeah.
They've taken a series of measures to reduce dependency on the dollar as a store of value and as a store of savings for people. So they've done things like they've created this cryptocurrency called the Petro, that we talked about in 4 or 5 or 6 conversations ago, which is pegged to the value of the international value of a barrel of oil. So, and that by using that and as a peg for the new, as a measure of the value of the new Bolivar Soberano currency, and that has stripped away, to some extent, to a large extent, but not completely, the ability of the speculative mechanisms set up by the United States and its local allies to destabilize the Venezuelan currency. And they've introduced measures like they're encouraging people to save in small units of gold, so that people don't, instead of trying to buy dollars and hold on to those dollars as a store of value to protect their savings, people can buy small amounts of gold and as an alternative to saving their money in dollars. And they've taken a whole series of measures that affect the ability of people to defend their cost of living. For example, I think it's a total of 26 basic products that they've established and agreed prices for with local retailers and food distributors and distributors of basic products. So they're taking all those measures, and measures also to do with the availability of foreign currency, so that businesses can't claim that they don't have enough dollars to be able to produce stuff, and that's the reason why they have difficulty maintaining low prices. And that there's a whole series of arguments that, because I'm not an economist, I don't understand fully. But the fundamental thing is that at the same time as they're diversifying the economy and so that they're not entirely dependent on oil production for national income, they're also managing to stabilize the currency, stabilize the prices that people have to pay for basic goods across the country. And that whole series of measures are really revolutionary in terms of Venezuela's economy, which has historically always depended on oil and the dollar. And now what they've done is they've said, right, we're no longer going to run the economy so that we're solely dependent on oil. We're going to diversify away from oil, and we're also going to stabilize our currency by taking a series of measures that reduce dependency on the dollar. Now that is very much in tune with what other countries that have been subject to sanctions, like principally the Russian Federation,
right,
are taking, but also Iran, for example. They're also taking very similar measures to what's happening in Venezuela. And so symbolic of all that was the visit of President Nicolas Maduro to China over the last, I think it was last week, he was there for 3 days. And there they signed a series of agreements that essentially what China is doing by signing those agreements is saying to the United States, we are going to bankroll Venezuela come what may. What they're doing is, what Venezuela, perhaps the most fundamental thing that Venezuela's done is that it said that it's going to guarantee China $1 million of a million barrels of oil a day in the next couple of years, which means that they're going to have to dramatically ramp up their oil production, and that China has agreed to help them do that. But that, and you probably understand better than I do, Don, what the implications are of that for the United States, because by doing that, what China is saying to the United States, we are not going to let you sink Venezuela. It's right. Very similar to, in a different kind of context, obviously, more in an economic context, although we can talk about the military aspect also. It's very similar to what Russia has done with Syria. What Russia has done with Syria is say to the United States, we are not going to let you destroy Syria. And now China is saying to the United States, we are not going to let you destroy Venezuela.
Well, this is also, I would say, much more similar to what China did when the U.S. tried to sanction Russia after the coup in Ukraine. The U.S. imposed all these sanctions on Russia at that time. Then they were targeting the banking system, for example. And, you know, they were basically looking to create economic chaos in the country. And so China turned around and signed the largest business deal, at least up to that point, in the history of humanity, to buy natural gas and other petroleum products from Russia, from Siberia. And they started to build a pipeline to deliver that stuff. There was a $500 billion deal, if memory serves, $485 billion or something over 30 years or some long-term deal. And they signed it and they've implemented it. And that was China's response to a U.S. attack on Russian economic sovereignty. And so this is kind of the, you know, smaller version of that.
Yeah, and in the big difference, sorry, the big difference, Don, is that in Russia's case, Russia is able to offer a credible military deterrent to the United States, whereas Venezuela is much more vulnerable from that point of view. But in with regard to that, and I think that both in Venezuela's case and in other cases as well, that maybe we can talk about later, Nicaragua, for example, and that that you can see that there seems to be an inverse relation between the ability of the United States to maintain its control in the region, which is in decline, that ability is in decline,
right,
and its military threats. And so you get people like Marco Rubio in particular, who seems to be one of the most, if not the most, influential voice in terms of defining U.S. government foreign policy in the region, in particular towards Cuba, obviously, but also towards Venezuela, Nicaragua, and elsewhere, Bolivia, Argentina. But so the United States is quite careful about the tools that it uses to make its threats. So it'll use the new Colombian president Iván Duque, for example, to make belligerent noises against Venezuela.
Right.
But that rhetoric, the interventionist rhetoric, the threat of a military intervention, was most acutely voiced over the last few days by OAS President Luis Almagro.
Right, and Pompeo, too.
Yep,
Michael Pompeo also, yeah.
But the what was what was so dramatic about Almagro's remarks was that he made them right there on the border with and between Colombia and Venezuela. He's supposedly visiting Venezuela to see the effects of Venezuelan migration into Colombia, which is ironic, but we can talk about that also later if we have time.
Yeah.
But he made those remarks saying that all options should be on the table with regard to Venezuela, including military intervention.
Right.
Which is absolutely outrageous completely illegal from the point of view of his status as the Secretary General of the Organization of American States.
Right.
Which is an organization supposedly devoted to promoting peace and stability in the region.
Yeah, he's in the border city of Cúcuta and says, as for a military intervention, we should not rule out any option.
Right.
Police. Right. You know, who is this guy?
So, and Luis Almagro is the Secretary General. He's the Secretary General of the Organization of American States.
That's right.
And what he said there in Cúcuta, and people should be calling for his resignation. In fact, Venezuela called for his resignation.
Yeah.
And Nicaragua called for his resignation because what he said is outright illegal. And
right.
He has no business as the leader of the Organization of American States saying that. And of course, he's subject to the international law that governs all the states of the United
That's
Nations.
Right, the UN Charter, all of that, yeah. Nuremberg principles.
And right. And it was interesting to see that the Uruguayan government, because Luis Almagro, I think he used to be the foreign minister of Uruguay.
That's correct.
Back under the administration of the first administration of Tabaré Vázquez,
yep.
The current Uruguayan president. And Vázquez came out and said that they strongly condemn Luis Almagro's remarks, and if he comes up for re-election, Uruguay will definitely not be voting for him, which is a kind of in diplomatic terms, that's an unprecedented rebuke,
right?
By the country of which Luis Almagro is a national, and has been a public servant for many years.
Right.
So, but I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how significant is that in terms of a potential military intervention in Venezuela? Well, and one has to look at that in the context of the fact that in the Organization of American States Permanent Council, the United States and its allies like Canada and so forth have been completely unable to get a majority that would enable them to condemn Venezuela to sanctions from agreed in the Organization of American States as a body. And so because they've been unable to do that, what they've done is they've set up this ad hoc group called the Lima Group, which is a group of all the right-wing governments.
Right.
All the countries with right-wing governments in the region. And that Lima Group over the last couple of years has been one of the key mechanisms for applying diplomatic pressure within the region against Venezuela. And over the last couple of months, for example, they've tried to exploit in a completely bogus way, a completely baseless way, the issue of Venezuelan migration to the rest of the region. As an issue causing, that they're trying to say that refugees from Venezuela destabilizing the region. That's the U.S.
Right.
Provoked argument, which
right.
is ridiculous because
right.
Venezuela has more migrants from Colombia,
right.
and it's got something like 2 million people in Venezuela are of Colombian descent refugees from Colombia's some civil war over the last 50 years.
Oh, right, over almost six decades. I mean, there's that, too. You've had that problem has been glaring for more than a half a century. And now some of the flow goes the other way. It's time to invade.
Yeah, and much of that flow are people of Colombian descent who are returning to Colombia.
Right,
so it's completely false to say that
right. There's
some kind of refugee crisis.
Right, that's right.
Anyway, and the interesting thing about the Lima group is that although they've, as a block, the United States has been able to exploit them quite successfully for that kind of psychological warfare stroke diplomatic offensive against Venezuela. And now what's happening is that even the right-wing government of Brazil, for example, is having second thoughts about whether it's a really good idea to string along with the U.S. plans for the Lima group in terms of Venezuela, because Venezuela, for example, supplies electricity to I think at least two or three of the northern the states in northern Brazil, because Brazil has been unable to generate enough electricity to meet the demands of electricity consumers in those northern states. And so they've been supplied by electricity from Venezuela.
Right.
And they owe, it's not a very significant amount in the terms of bilateral relations between nations. It's something like $40 million or something, the debt that Brazilian state owes Venezuela's electricity generating company. But they're unable to, it's not that they don't want to pay it or they don't have the money to pay it, but the U.S. sanctions make it impossible for them to pay it.
Right.
And so what Venezuela is saying to Brazil is, we understand your difficulties as a result of the U.S. sanctions, and there's no way that we're going to deny electricity to the people in Brazil just because U.S. sanctions have made it impossible for the Brazilian authorities to make that payment.
Right.
And that humanitarian gesture, because if they worked on a capitalist basis, they'd say no money, no electricity.
That's right. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And they just shut down electricity
to
a couple of states in northern Brazil, with all that would mean for the Brazilian government.
Yeah, and just to think about it for a minute, we could be talking about power being supplied, say, to Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont from Canada or whatever.
Yeah. So even the right wing government of the usurper government of Michel Temer,
right,
have had to modify their stance towards Venezuela within that context, and also at the same time you have. In Mexico, you have Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He should be taking office, and I think at the end of the year he takes office from Peña Nieto. And so, although he isn't able right now to implement the kind of more balanced foreign policy from Mexico in the region, that you can see the effects on the Mexican diplomacy in the region, and they too are not being as aggressive as they might be. And also you have something that we've talked about in several conversations that we've had over the last months, the rapprochement between Bolivia and Peru in relation to the transcontinental railway, and that too has its effect. Bolivian diplomacy in South America has its effect in mollifying and mitigating the more extreme rhetoric that you're getting against Venezuela from countries like Argentina or Chile, for example, where the right-wing governments have maintained extremely hostile stances towards Venezuela.
Yeah.
But, and so the Lima group is by no means the monolithic block that the United States hoped to be able to use
right.
to hammer Venezuela with. I mean, it's they're basically falling apart. One of the reasons that they're falling apart, of course, is the crisis in Argentina.
Right.
And that has to do with, you know, in regional terms, just look at what's happening. Venezuela has survived years and years of economic sanctions and attempts at regime change. And its economy is stable, although suffering difficulties. And there you have Argentina. Nobody's attacking Argentina. Argentina hasn't been subject to sanctions. Argentina hasn't been subject to relentless regime change measures taken by the United States. And it's in crisis. It can't pay its debts. It's having to go to the IMF to ask for more money, as you and I predicted it would.
Yep.
The labor unions there, the main labor union organizations, are holding a 36-hour strike that's affecting the Buenos Aires subway. It's affecting local air travel. It's affecting local schools. And even at the height of the crisis in Venezuela, you never had that kind of national strike.
Yeah, and you have also... that's emblematic of the fundamental problem. Unemployment, when you have high unemployment, of course, you're not going to solve the other financial and economic problems because people don't have any money to spend to goose the engine. And particularly when you go back to a neoliberal basis, you need to have that happen. And now the unemployment figures are the highest that they've been since Nestor Kirchner took office in 2004. Right. In other words, the same situation that the last round of neoliberal reforms, quote-unquote, that the Chicago boys imposed on Argentina that tanked the economy and made it a global basket case that was rescued by Kirchner and by Cristina and by the popular movement there.
And by Hugo Chavez
and by the entire project that took place in, you know, the whole pink tide, as it was called. All of that solved those problems, and it's less than 3 years after Macri got elected and imposed this neoliberal model back on Argentina that they're back to where they were 12 years ago.
Yeah, and that has effects both obviously internally in Argentina.
Right.
And that in Argentina you can see in the same way that the judicial and electoral authorities in Brazil are working overtime to kind of make Lula da Silva a non-person,
right,
refusing him the permission to do video messages or right, audio messages or even written messages, as I understand
right,
it, in support of the candidate that has substituted for him in the upcoming presidential elections in Brazil, Fernando Haddad.
Right.
In the same way that the Brazilian authorities are suppressing the very existence of Lula da Silva, the Argentinian judicial authorities are desperately trying, and they're clutching at any straw to be able to submerge Cristina Fernandez in legal processes
that will make
it impossible for her to stand as a candidate in the forthcoming elections that I think in Argentina are next year.
That's right. God forbid that she drives her car through a toll booth or something and one of the coins misses the basket. They'll have her in prison for 30 years so she can't run for office.
And we
have to stop here because we're out of time.
All right.
But we'll pick it up here and take a look at some of the other things in the region, too, that we didn't get to, including Evo Morales running for re-election and the whole thing that's going on between Argentina, Peru, and also Nicaragua. Tony, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as usual.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.